think recent philosophy has still not really come to terms with the special character of Wittgenstein's work. The resurgence, or perhaps I should say surge, of interest in Wittgenstein's work that I have in mind certainly began in response to Saul Kripke's Wittgenstein on Rules in Private Language in 1982. Many people who had never had any interest in Wittgenstein before, put it mildly, suddenly began to write about him, or at least about something they called the rule-following considerations so provocatively presented in that book, Kripke's book. That book presented a challenge to say what it is about a person that constitutes his meaning some particular thing, say the addition function, by a certain expression he uses. And Kripke argued for the skeptical paradox, no present or past facts involving the person could constitute his meaning or understanding of expression in one determinate way rather than another, incompatible with it. The problem could easily be generalized from meaning or understanding a word to a question about any thought or intentional attitudes at all. The mind and its contents in general appeared to suffer from a puzzling and unavoidable indeterminacy. Pressed to the limit, there appeared to be no such fact as a person's thinking or meaning or understanding something in one particular way rather than another. Now, Wittgenstein's relation to this paradox or challenge has come to be understood in any one of several different ways. And oversimplifying and schematizing crudely, we could say that the interpretative situation looks something like this. One line of interpretation says that in philosophical investigations, Wittgenstein gives arguments for the paradoxical conclusion that no one thinks or means or understands anything in one way rather than another. Now, whether he actually accepted that conclusion or not is a question on which views divide. Some views say he did accept it, but that the effects of such a skeptical paradox were mitigated by his also accepting what Kripke called a skeptical solution to it. And that solution involves making sense of our talk of thinking and meaning and understanding things as we do, without assuming that sentences like A means plus by the plus sign are ever true. And to this interpretation, there is sometimes added the historical observation that the shift from a so-called truth conditions to a so-called assertability conditions theory of meaning marks a significant change from Wittgenstein's earlier to his later work. Now, an opposed view says that Wittgenstein did not accept the paradoxical conclusion, despite his having given strong arguments in his favor. The aim was rather to present a problem or challenge. And one view along these lines says that Wittgenstein also met the challenge, or at least tried to. He agreed that no fact about any person or speaker considered in isolation can ever fix what the person means or understands by what he says or does. But by considering what an individual does in relation to a general practice in his community, we can get sufficient conditions for his meaning this or that, or for his following a rule correctly. This would be a positive solution to the problem, what has come to be called a community view of rule following or correctness. And it's widely believed, I think, that this view doesn't work. Now, a different line of interpretation is that Wittgenstein raised the problem that Kripke presents, but offered no solution to it at all. On this view, it's thought that for him to have done so would have meant engaging in constructive philosophical theorizing, which he's believed to have disparaged all throughout his later writings. He was just not that kind of philosopher. Now, this, it must be said, can be a somewhat dispiriting line of interpretation. It's perhaps understandable that someone would offer no solution to a problem he didn't even recognize. But once this problem has been identified, and its force has been made plain, ignoring it or denying its force would look like simply turning away from something that cries out for philosophical explanation and understanding. dismissive attitude would be especially puzzling in someone who invented or discovered this very problem in the face. And that's just what Crispin Wright believes. He thinks, as he says, that Wittgenstein essentially invented this philosophical problem. And, he says, that was an astonishing feat of philosophical perceptiveness and creativity. So how then can we explain Wittgenstein's refusal to solve it? Well, David Peres, too, finds Wittgenstein evasive on what he calls the question that we all want to hear him answer. What constitutes a person's following a rule correctly? Or as David Peres puts it, what underpins the practice of the community in speaking as it does and keeps its vocalizations on the rails? How can we explain Wittgenstein's apparent refusal to say anything positive on this question? It would seem that only complacency or a distaste for what Crispin Wright calls constructive philosophical action could account for such evasion. But then, what accounts for that complacency or distaste? Well, these are some of the best-known current interpretations of Wittgenstein, and they vary widely and they disagree among themselves on many points. But I want to suggest that every one of them still fails to come to terms with the special character, or perhaps I should say the special stance, of Wittgenstein's work. All these interpretations try to place Wittgenstein somewhere within a set of possible positions on a question whose source, I believe, he makes great efforts to show lies in an identifiable confusion. Now, the deeper roots of that confusion can perhaps be felt and appreciated, but they cannot be overcome by giving an answer to that question. So I want to try to explain this by sketching what I think Wittgenstein actually does with the idea of a person's thinking or meaning or understanding something in a particular way. Now, this is a question that he was concerned with almost from the beginning of his return to philosophy in Cambridge in 1929, not to mention earlier, of course, too. Behind his whole treatment of it in his later work, there remains what he had in mind in a remark that he wrote to himself, as it were, in 1931. He says this: "The limit of language is shown by its being impossible to describe the fact which corresponds to or is the translation of a sentence without simply repeating that sentence." Let me read that again. "The limit of language is shown by its being impossible to describe the fact which corresponds to a sentence without simply repeating the sentence." And to this he added in parentheses, "This has to do with the Kantian solution of the problem of philosophy." So I will do what I can to explain what I think are some of the implications of this rich, enigmatic remark. At the very beginning of Philosophical Grammar, also in 1931, Wittgenstein is concerned with how one can talk about understanding and not understanding a proposition. By understanding, he has in mind what he calls a psychological reaction while hearing, reading, uttering, etc., a sentence. In the Tractatus, he had spoken of a sentence as the expression of a thought in a form perceptible to the senses. So the understanding he has in mind here is what he calls the phenomenon that occurs when I hear a sentence in a familiar language and not when I hear a sentence in a strange language. I understand a sentence in a language familiar to me as soon as I hear it or see it. What I understand are those signs or marks right there on the page. I understand what they express. Wittgenstein thinks it would even make sense in certain special circumstances to ask, "Do you understand what this clump of trees says?" He thinks someone could express something by arranging a clump of trees in a certain way, as a kind of code, say. And someone could see the trees and understand what they say. Now, we could say that someone who sees the trees and understands what they say knows what proposition those trees express. And we could say the same of someone who sees and understands a sentence. But we cannot say that such a person also understands that proposition he knows to be expressed by those trees, or that sentence, in the way he understands the clump of trees or the sentence. It isn't that he knows what proposition the trees or the sentence express, and also knows what proposition that proposition in turn expresses. Apart from the clump of trees, or the sentence there on the page, there is no such further item to express or mean anything. Once he understands what the clump of trees or the sentence says, or he knows what proposition it expresses, there's nothing else in the situation for the person to understand. But now, what's the difference between clumps of trees or marks on a page that are propositions that can be understood, and those that are not, and mean or express nothing? Well, simply, as clumps of trees, or as marks on a page, we're tempted to say, there is no difference. Considering a clump of trees as simply what Wittgenstein calls a phenomenon or fact, we don't thereby recognize that it expresses anything, that it was arranged with a certain purpose at all. The meaningful or intentional aspect of a clump of trees seems to be absent from the phenomenon as such. Now, the same is true of what a person does in expressing an expectation, for example, or a wish, or in carrying out an order, when those events are considered in that same way as a phenomenon or fact. To recognize that people do such things, express expectations or wishes or carry out orders, we have to be able to read off from their expression of the thought or expectation or wish that it is the thought or expectation or wish that such and such. But if we regard the people around us and marks on paper and clumps of trees and so on solely as phenomena in the sense Wittgenstein has in mind, it looks as if we could never recognize anything or anyone as thinking or meaning or understanding it. To see them only as phenomena in that sense would be to see them, as Wittgenstein puts it, only from outside. Now, from outside, this phrase, used in this way, obviously does not mean simply from a position outside the other person, or even outside his mind, any more than it means from a position outside a sentence or outside a clump of trees. It's not that standing inside a clump of trees is a better way of finding out what it says. Seeing a clump of trees, or marks on a paper, or people's making noises, or behaving in certain other ways, seeing all those things from outside, in this sense, is to consider such things independently of their expressing anything, or of their having any meaning. As Wittgenstein puts it in Philosophical Grammar, if we consider them from outside, we have to understand thoughts as thoughts, intentions as intentions, without getting any information about something's meaning. Anything looked at only in that way, he says, from outside, will appear lifeless and isolated. It does not point outside itself to a reality beyond, as Wittgenstein puts it. Looking at things only in that way would mean that we could not recognize any thoughts or intentions or meanings at all. As Wittgenstein describes his plight, whatever phenomenon we saw, it couldn't ever be intention, for that has to contain the very thing that's intended. And any phenomenon would be something complete in itself and unconcerned with anything outside itself, something merely dead if considered by itself. Now that, of course, is not the plight that we are actually in. As things are, we can see a sentence or a clump of trees and know what it says, if there is something it says. And we can see people who think and mean things. But as Wittgenstein again puts it in Philosophical Grammar, if a thought is observed, there can be no further question of an understanding. For if the thought is seen, it must be recognized as a thought with a certain content. It doesn't need to be interpreted. That really is, he says, when we are thinking, there isn't any interpretation going on. Now, when a person's thinking has been observed, there can be no further question of an understanding, as he says, because there is nothing further to be understood. It's not just that the thought then doesn't need to be interpreted. There's nothing relevant that could be interpreted. We see a sentence or a clump of trees, and we know what it says. We do not then see it from outside all thought and meaning. It's only when we do not see it from outside all meaning that we understand it. Now this means, I think, that we cannot specify what a certain sentence expresses or how a person understands a certain expression if we try to do so from outside all recognition of what some things mean or what some people intend. We cannot capture any such intentional facts in descriptions which restrict themselves to what Wittgenstein calls mere phenomena, which give no information about something's meaning. And I think this is implied by the enigmatic remark which I read at the beginning, that it's impossible to describe the fact that corresponds to a sentence without simply repeating the sentence. Of course, when you repeat the sentence, then you are expressing something with meaning. Now, I understand describing the fact that corresponds to the sentence here to be a matter of saying or indicating what the sentence says or means. It's not simply saying what happens to be so whenever the sentence is true. We've just seen the point made in philosophical grammar that we would never be able to specify what any expression means or how it's understood if we were restricted to describing its use only from outside all information about thought or meaning. But the point Wittgenstein is making in this enigmatic remark from which I began appears to be much stronger. He appears to be saying that the meaning of a particular expression cannot be fully specified from outside or independently of using or repeating that very expression. Well, is that true? Is it true that we cannot say what a sentence means or describe the fact that corresponds to it without simply repeating that very sentence? Well, strictly speaking, perhaps maybe it's not true. Maybe we don't have to repeat the very sentence just as it is without any change. If we have another expression that means the same as the one we're interested in, then it looks as if we could use that synonym to say what the first expression means without repeating that first expression. Now this raises the question whether there are any two sentences with exactly the same meaning. And if so, whether they express the same fact. But I think the main point that Wittgenstein is making here would remain, even if we put the point more cautiously, as follows. It's impossible to say what a sentence means or describe the fact that corresponds to it without using something close to that very sentence or another with the same meaning. The important point is that in giving the meaning of a sentence, we must use a sentence close to the original, and not simply mention a sentence. And to do that is to do so, so to speak, from within language, as it were, not from outside. To do it from within a recognition of the meaning or significance of something about it. Now, obviously, in saying what a sentence means, or in describing the fact that corresponds to it, in doing that, we produce some words, typically a sentence. We produce those words in an effort to say what the original sentence means. But we do not say what the original sentence means by saying that the sentence we produce means the same as the sentence in question. That would be to mention two sentences, or to mention the same sentence twice, and say that those two sentences mean the same. But when we repeat the original sentence by way of indicating what mention the sentence. When we utter the words we use to say what the original sentence means, the words we produce are not said to have the same meaning as the original sentence. We give the meaning of the original sentence in saying what we say. If all we managed to say was that two mentioned expressions have the same meaning, if that's all we managed to say, then we would not succeed in giving that meaning or in specifying what the original sentence means. That's because to say of one sentence that it means the same as another is not to say anything about what that sentence means. I can know and say that a certain Turkish sentence means the same as a certain sentence in Urdu without understanding the word of either of those two languages. All I know is that two sentences mean the same. So knowledge of the mentioned expressions is not enough for knowing the meaning of those expressions. That's why I think Wittgenstein is right to stress that some words must be used with a definite meaning and not simply mentioned in saying what an expression means or in describing the fact that corresponds to a given sentence. And this is why I think it's also right to say that someone who understands what a certain sentence or a clump of trees says, and in that sense knows what proposition it expresses, does not simply know of a certain item, namely a proposition, that it is expressed by a certain other thing, a sentence or a clump of trees. That too would be to know only that two items stand in a certain relation, but it would not necessarily be to know what either of those items means. But as Wittgenstein points out at the beginning of Philosophical Grammar, to know what a sentence means is to be able to answer the question, what does this sentence say? And being able to answer that question involves being able to say what the sentence says, not simply to say that it means or means or says the same as some other sentence. So that's what I think Wittgenstein is saying in those early works, Philosophical Grammar, Philosophical Remarks. But now we might ask, why should we accept what Wittgenstein says about the impossibility of understanding language and meaning from outside in this way? Even if it has the implications that I've mentioned, what supports what looks like simply a denial of the possibility of explaining the intentional somehow in terms of the non-intentional? Now here we have to look at something else I think Wittgenstein does with the idea of a person's understanding something in a particular way. And I think the best and most familiar example of this is to be found in those well-known passages in Philosophical Investigations 185 and following, where we have a pupil who, by all the usual criteria, has mastered the instructions he's been given in the continuation of different arithmetical series. On being given the number 2 and the order add 2 each time, he writes down 4, 6, 8, 10, and so on. We heartlessly insist that he keep going, and he dutifully plods on 996, 998, 1000, 1004, 1008. At that point, we tell him to stop. Now, I think it's clear that this pupil has not followed the order he was given, or he's not followed it correctly, which comes to the same thing. Does he or did he understand the order he was given? Well, perhaps. If he says he just got tired of applying the rule add 2, and after 1,000 he started applying a different rule, then we could say that he understood the original order, but he refused to follow it after a certain point. But if he responds as Wittgenstein imagines him, by saying, when we point out that he's written down 1,004 and 1,008, yes, but isn't that right? I thought that was how I was meant to do it. Or if he says, but I did go on in the same way after 1,000 as before, then I think we all recognize that he did not understand the order he was given. He did not follow that order correctly. Now we know that because we know what the pupil did after 1,000 is not in accord with the order as it same order after 1,000 as he was before, then the order he followed was not the order added to each time. And that means that even before reaching 1,000, he was following the order added to each time, even though every number he wrote down was in fact two more than the previous number. The sequence he wrote up to 1,000 was in that sense in accord with or in agreement with the rule added to each time, but that was not the rule that he was following. Now, Wittgenstein was fond of arithmetical series in discussing meaning and understanding because they served to bring out a fundamental point. When a person continuing a series has written down at any given time never uniquely determines what rule he is following. His understanding of his instructions is shown or expressed in his doing what he does, but the outcomes of those actions, the numbers he writes down, do not fix what his understanding is, no matter how many numbers he writes. His having written the numbers is compatible with his understanding what he's doing in indefinitely many different ways. Taking up Wittgenstein's phrase from Philosophical Grammar, we could say that with respect to fixing what the person understands, the numbers written there on the page represent only something viewed from outside. They are to that extent lifeless and isolated phenomenon or fact, which do not point beyond themselves to how they are or were understood. Now, of course, in considering this example as we do not view everything the pupil does completely from outside all thought and meaning. I've spoken of writing down numbers, but what the pupil writes on the page are, strictly speaking, numerals, which we understand to stand for numbers. So that part of it is a matter of meaning. And we imagine the pupil to have written those numerals intentionally in response to some instructions, not to have produced them as a snail might leave a numeral-shaped mark in the sand. So we're imagining that there's intentional activity. In entertaining the story as we do, we take the pupil to understand the order in some way or other, and to have certain intentional attitudes. But even if we grant that the pupil intentionally writes numerals and means each one of them to stand for a number, and we know which numbers they stand for, we still cannot determine what rule he is following as long as we're restricted to describing the numbers only, so to speak, from outside in that way. The same holds for any attempted specification of the meaning or sound, the meaning of the sound or marks added to each time by which the order was given to the pupil. Considered as a phenomenon or fact complete in itself, that sign or sound added to each time could mean or could have meant any number of different things or nothing at all. Viewed outside all information about thought or meaning, it obviously imposes no constraints on what the pupil is supposed to do when he hears or sees it. We know that the pupil violated the constraints imposed by the order as it was meant. He did not follow it correctly. So we obviously do not view that sound or mark added to each time in only that outside way which imposes no constraints. We understand the expression add to each time. We know how it was meant. And the meaning of that expression, or how it was meant, is what determines what step is to be taken at each point. Wittgenstein asks in 190, what determines how the order was meant? And he answers, the kind of way we always use it, the way we are taught to use it. Now, as a general observation about meaning, this must be right. There can be nothing more to an expression having a certain meaning than its being used in a certain determinate way. And knowing what an expression means can be nothing other than knowing how it is or has been used. But if used is what is appealed to in accounting for our understanding of meaning, that use must be described in a certain way, or the idea of use must be understood in a certain way. It is possible, after all, to say something that's true of all those occasions on which a certain expression was used in the past. And in that sense, it's possible to give a description of the past use without thereby specifying the meaning of that expression. And the same holds even if the description is true of all future applications as well as all past applications of the expression as well. So use described only in such ways, or the description of use given in that way, does not determine the meaning of expression. For example, just to idealize a little, suppose everyone in the past had always responded to the sound add two each time with a series of numbers, each of which is two more than the previous number. It does not follow that those words mean that two is to be added each time, or that that's what is ordered by anyone who utters that sentence to give an order. And that doesn't follow even if everyone, in fact, continues to respond in that same way forever in the future, always by putting a number two more than the previous one. That, I think, is the important point. And I think we can see that it's precisely the point that's illustrated by the simple case of what we could call this deviant pupil. Every number that pupil wrote down before 1,000 was two more than the previous number. But that did not imply that he was following the rule of two each time. If we grant that he could be following some other order correctly even before he reaches 1,000, or that he could be understanding the words of that order differently from the way we do, if we accept that, then we thereby acknowledge that the expression add two each time could be or could have been an order to do something other than add two each time, even though every response to it in the past has involved adding two. The meaning of that sign cannot be read off its use if its use is understood only as the applications actually made of it described in that outside way. So we have to describe the use in some other way if the description of its use is to fix its meaning. Now we can describe the use of an expression in a way that does suffice to fix its meaning, or to specify what we know when we know its meaning. We can say something like this: the words add two each time are used by us to mean that two is to be added each time. Now here, we employ the idea of meaning in describing how the expression is used. We do not simply say something that's true of all or only those occasions on which the expression is applied. We say what it's used to mean on those occasions. We also make use of and do not just mention the very words whose use we are specifying. As I've imagined this particular explanation, we do not simply repeat the original sentence exactly as it is, although we could. We could just say, the words add two each time mean add two each time. The point is that in giving the explanation, we make use of the words in the original sentence. We do not just describe their use without using them. Now, there's no question, it seems to me, that we can describe what we mean in these ways. And there's no doubt that it succeeds in specifying the meaning of the words. The question is whether we must always describe the use of an expression in what I will call this engaged way in order to succeed in specifying its meaning. And I think reflection on Wittgenstein's treatment of examples like this can convince us that we must so describe the use if we're going to fix its meaning. We see that we cannot specify what something means or how someone understands something from outside all information about the meaning of expressions or the intentions with which they are used. But now, this seems to raise a difficulty. This is precisely the outcome that can seem to raise a challenge to the very idea of understanding or meaning something in a certain way. The challenge the case of the deviant pupil can be felt to represent could be expressed as follows, as Wittgenstein expresses it in paragraph 198 of the Investigations. But how can a rule show me what I have to do at this point? Whatever I do, it some interpretation in accord with the rule. To which Wittgenstein replies, that's not what we ought to say. But rather, every interpretation, together with what is being interpreted, hangs in the air. The former cannot give the latter any support. Interpretations by themselves do not determine meaning. Now, when he says interpretations by themselves do not determine meaning, I take him to be saying that producing one expression as an interpretation of another expression is not enough to specify what the first expression means or how it is to be understood. That must be so if giving an interpretation is not more than substituting one expression for another that's said to mean the same. Both expressions would still, so to speak, hang in the air without attaching themselves to any particular meaning. That's to say, as I put it earlier, synonymy of merely mentioned expressions is not enough to specify the meaning of either of those expressions. Now, to suppose that that's all we could ever do to specify or understand the meaning of any expression would lead to an infinite regress. If specifying or understanding the meaning of an expression always required another expression, and that expression in turn had to be understood, and that in turn required another expression, there would be no saying what any expression means and no understanding of anything. And this, I believe, is the source of the apparent paradox Wittgenstein states in Philosophical Investigations 201. If no course of action could be determined by a rule because every course of action can be made out to accord with the rule, then there would be neither accord nor conflict. Nothing would have any determinate meaning. This, Wittgenstein says, was our paradox. And it's precisely the so-called skeptical paradox that has generated so much of the current interest in Wittgenstein. Well, what's Wittgenstein's response? Does he try to say, in the face of the challenge, what actually constitutes a person's meaning or understanding something in a particular determinate way? Is that his response to the paradox? No, it is not. As we see in 201, Wittgenstein says that there is a misunderstanding behind this alleged paradox. The challenge rests on a confusion. We know the thought behind the paradox must be confused, because we've just seen that it's not true, as the so-called paradox claims, that every course of action can be made out to accord with any given rule. We know that what the deviant pupil did after 1000 is not in accord with the rule to add 2 each time, nor can it be made out to accord with that rule. The rule to add 2 each time requires that 1002 be put next after 1000. That's the course of action determined by that rule at that point, as we all know. And the deviant pupil did not do that. What is true is that what the deviant pupil does can be made out to accord with some rule which he could understand or might have understood to be expressed by the words add 2 each time. We can make sense of the pupil as having understood those words in what for us is some such deviant way. Perhaps the end is the words as an order that 2 is to be added each time up to 1000 and 4 is to be added after that. But to understand those words in that way is not to understand his deviant actions as being in accord with the rule to add 2 each time. We have seen that his actions are not in accord with that rule. Nor does thinking of him as understanding his instructions in this more complicated way that I described show that any action can be made out to accord with the rule he would then be following. follows that more complicated rule, add 2 up to 1,004 thereafter, it's a confusion to say that that pupil understands or interprets the rule to add 2 each time differently from the way we do. He does not. As we now imagine it, he does not interpret that rule at all. For one thing, there's no such thing for him to interpret. He interprets or understands in a certain way the words he hears. As we are now thinking of him, he takes the words add 2 each time to express the rule to add 2 up to 1,004 thereafter. But to understand those words in that way is to understand or interpret an expression of a rule in a certain way. It is not to interpret a rule. He understands those words to express a certain rule, but he does not in that same way understand that rule to express something in turn. As we saw, Wittgenstein put the point in philosophical grammar, once a person has understood the words in a certain way, there can be no further question of an understanding. There's nothing left to be understood. Similarly, we who understand or interpret the words add 2 each time as they normally are meant in English, understand them as expressing the rule to add 2 each time. We recognize what rule those words express. But it would be a confusion to say that we also, and in the same way, recognize what rule that rule expresses. As with a clump of trees that says something, once we understand what it says, there's nothing left to understand or interpret. Or, as the passage we saw earlier from Philosophical Grammar has it, that really is how it is. When we're thinking, there isn't any interpretation going on. So the demand that leads to the apparent paradox is the confused demand for what are often called more and more rules for interpreting rules. Or as Crispin Wright puts it in summarizing the challenge that he thinks Wittgenstein refuses to take up, how can there be what Crispin Wright calls something which carries determinate instructions for an open range of situations when anything I say or do in explaining it will be open to an indefinite variety of conflicting interpretations? The realization that we could never reach the end of any such chain of possible interpretations is what makes it look as if no distinction can ever be drawn between correct and incorrect applications, so there's no such thing as meaning or understanding something in a particular way. That's the source of the apparent paradox or challenge. Wittgenstein's reply in 201 is to say it can be seen that there is a misunderstanding here, and I think he's right. I tried to bring out what he thinks the misunderstanding is. The misunderstanding is the idea that meaning or understanding something in a particular way involves thinking or anyway somehow possessing something else which is also meant or understood in some way. But that thing in turn would stand in need of further interpretation or specification in order for it to be meant or understood in a particular way, and so on. And that really would make understanding or meaning anything impossible. But once we see through the confusion, there's no such threat of regress. When we say in language what our words mean and how they are to be understood, there's nothing else to be understood or interpreted other than the words we utter. Now, when I say in language, I mean the words that we use and do not just mention in saying what certain words mean. Those words themselves have a determined meaning as we're using them occasionally, and they are to be taken or understood in a certain way. And what we say will then have been understood. We've imagined the deviant pupil as understanding the expression add 2 each time to mean that 2 is to be added up to 1,004 thereafter. But now if we asked him, this deviant pupil, to say how he understands the expression add 2 each time, we could expect him to utter the words like this. The expression add 2 each time means that 2 is to be added each time. Or he might even say, add to each time means add to each time. He simply repeats the expression whose meaning he's explaining. And of course, that's exactly what we do too. We utter those same sounds in expressing our own understanding of what that expression means. The difference between what we say with those words and what the imagined deviant pupil says of the meaning of that expression obviously does not lie in the words that we all use to say what the meaning is. We use the same words. The difference lies in what we then use those words on that occasion to mean. And what someone who hears us takes in depends on how that person understands the words he hears or what meaning he thinks we give to them. So saying or understanding or being told anything about what an expression means is possible only, so to speak, from inside language in Wittgenstein's sense. It's possible only by already taking something to be meant or understood in a certain way. Now, it seems obvious that no one could understand what he's told about what an expression means unless he understood the words in which he's told it. No one could understand anything he's told unless he understood the words in which he's told it. But for explicit meaning in particular, this fact can give rise to a certain philosophical dissatisfaction. And I think this is perhaps the syncopation that David Peres was talking about this morning. I think there's a deeply felt philosophical expectation or demand that meaning must or should be explainable or made intelligible in some other better way than that. And this is probably the real source of what Wittgenstein calls the misunderstanding behind the apparent paradox. It's hard to be sure about that. That's a diagnostic claim. But I think that in philosophy, there's a feeling that meaning, at least simple, basic meaning from which all the rest can be derived, should or must somehow be intelligible and available somehow from outside language, in the sense in which Wittgenstein uses that phrase. This, I believe, is thought by many to be a condition of set of a properly philosophical theory of meaning. Now, one reason for insisting on such an account of meaning is perhaps the worry that if meaning could not be accounted for in that way, how could we ever acquire a language in the first place? How could we get into language at all if explanation of the meaning of something can succeed only for those who already understand the words in which those explanations are expressed? This is what makes ostensive teaching or ostensive learning look fundamental. And I think it is fundamental in a pretty obvious way. We learn the meanings of some words in the presence of things that the words stand for. It's hard to see how any words could be connected with the things we talk about at all if that were not so. But ostensive learning or ostensive definition or explanation is no exception, I think, to the idea that you must already be operating, so to speak, from inside language or meaning in order to understand explanations of meaning. This is what Wittgenstein brings out, I think, in the early sections of Philosophical Investigations. It's another version of the idea behind his treatment of the deviant pupil's understanding of arithmetical series. A sound's being uttered over and over again in the presence of objects of a certain kind does not alone fix the meaning of that sound or anyone's understanding of it. It doesn't matter how long the ritual goes on. Taken on its own as a phenomenon or fact, so to speak, the correlation between sound and object remains as outside the meaning of the sound or how it is to be understood as was the series of numbers written down by the deviant pupil. How the definition is understood depends on what the pupil learns to do with the word. That determines what kind of word he takes it to be. So the ostensive explanation succeeds in showing or telling the meaning of the word only if, in Wittgenstein's phrase, the place for such a word was already prepared. The place has to be prepared within whatever linguistic or other capacities the pupil already possesses. There must already be, in this metaphor of Wittgenstein's, there must already be a post at which the pupil can station the word, whose job is to give the word. Now, it might seem that it would be enough for the pupil simply to recognize what the teacher is pointing at when he's giving an ostensive definition, but he cannot do that if he sees the teacher's finger and the object, so to speak, only from outside all thought and meaning. And to recognize the intention with which the ostension is carried out, he must recognize it as an intention or thought with a certain content. So that content must be intelligible to the pupil if he can recognize its presence. He must have some idea of what a color is, for example, or a shape, or rather than a building stone, if he's to understand the sound he hears as a word for something of one of those kinds. Now, as far as I can see, none of this represents a threat to our coming to speak as we do and knowing what we know about the meanings of the expressions we use. It means only that we do not get into language by having the meanings of all words stated or otherwise explained to us. Nor do we figure it out for ourselves if that means somehow observing from outside the conditions under which words are uttered and deriving from that the idea of meaning and the meanings of particular expressions. Facts of words meaning what they do cannot be constructed out of materials available from outside all thought and meaning in that way. In the manuscript of Philosophical Remarks, slightly earlier than Philosophical Grammar, Wittgenstein had written this: any kind of explanation of a language presupposes a language already. And in a certain sense, the use of language is something that cannot be taught, i.e., I cannot use language to teach it in the way in which language could be used to teach someone to play the piano. And that, of course, is just another way of saying, I cannot use language to get outside language. Philosophical Grammar put the point this way: what is spoken can only be explained in language. And so in this sense, language itself cannot be explained. Language must speak for itself. Language itself cannot be explained in the sense, I think, that no account can be given of how information available to someone who does not speak could be used to conduct that person on the basis of such information into knowledge of the meanings of linguistic expression, and so into language. Not because there is no such knowledge of meaning to be had, and not because the knowledge cannot be expressed in language. There is such knowledge, and we all have it, and the knowledge we have can be expressed in language. But we have that knowledge as a result of being able to speak. It's not knowledge that can be used to give someone knowledge of meaning, or to instruct or guide someone into meaning or understanding something in a particular way. And that's because no one could receive any of the proffered information without already possessing at least some measure of what the instructions were trying to impart. All of us start out with no mastery of any part of any language, and we are brought to full mastery by training, interaction, and socialization with those who speak and live as we come to do. This is a fact of human life. It's also part of what Wittgenstein calls the natural history of human beings. He says that commanding, questioning, recounting, chatting, and so on, which after all are all linguistic activities, that these things are as much a part of our natural history as walking, eating, drinking, playing. So our thinking and meaning and understanding things in the way we do is in that sense a contingent fact. Things could have been otherwise, and in that sense, things could be otherwise tomorrow. Does that mean that there's something precarious about our continuing to mean and understand things as we do? Well, if it does mean that, and if what I've been drawing attention to is right, then we have to concede that there is nothing beyond the ways we already understand and mean things that we could consult for instructions about how to continue to do it, or to continue to do it correctly. purely. Nothing fully independent could tell us what we have to do to get our applications of words into accord with the meanings we've given to them or want to attach to them. Nothing outside all meaning and understanding could serve as a check that our vocalizations are indeed on the rails, as it were. Nothing can fulfill such a function. And there's no set of conditions independent of all considerations of meaning or understanding that we could discover to be sufficient to constitute a person's meaning or understanding and expression in a certain way. So there is, in that sense, I think, no foundation to thought or language, nothing on which thought and meaning can be seen to rest. As Wittgenstein puts in the remarks on the foundations of mathematics, to what extent, he asks, can the function of language be described? If someone is not sure of their own language, I may bring him to a mastery of it by training. Someone who is master of it, I may remind with the kind of training, or I may describe it for a particular purpose, thus already using the technique of the language. I can do all that. The difficult thing here, he says, is not to dip down to the ground. No, the difficult thing is to recognize that the ground that lies before us is the ground. For the ground keeps on giving us the illusory image of a greater depth, and when we seek to reach this, we keep on finding ourselves at the old level. Or as he sums it up, our disease is one of wanting to explain. Well, by conclusion, let me just say this. It's at this point, I think, if not earlier, that many people begin to feel the definite philosophical disappointment, to put no further point on it. But I think that by now, the object or cause of the disappointment cannot be simply evasion or a refusal to answer a definite question, especially when we've seen the reasons why there cannot be an explanation of meaning of the kind that those who feel disappointment might seek. And we know that it takes a sustained, intricate investigation to bring this situation clearly into view, as I believe Wittgenstein has done. So I don't think it can be a case of complacency or simply turning away from an identifiable problem either. After all, what I've been trying to sketch is Wittgenstein's philosophical response to the human fact of meaning or understanding something. Now, it's true, it's not a so-called constitutive analysis of that fact. It does not give illuminating or explanatory necessary and sufficient conditions for someone's understanding something in a particular determinate way. But I think it does explain, or at least exhibit, why such a thing is not to be had. I remind you that Wittgenstein's remark, the enigmatic remark with which I began, that it's impossible to describe the fact that corresponds to a sentence without simply repeating the sentence, is immediately followed by the observation, as he puts it, in that maddeningly loose phrase of his, this has to do with the Kantian solution of the problem of philosophy. Not the problems of philosophy, plural, the problem of philosophy, singular. Now I take this to be the problem of how there can be such a thing as philosophy, how there can be profitable philosophical reflection on such matters as thought, meaning, and understanding. The key to the Kantian solution was to find the conditions of that possibility only within what we are already capable of. There is no accounting for what needs to be understood somehow from outside all of it. That was the Kantian idea. So what we have seen Wittgenstein say about language, Kant could well have said about thought. Our thinking what we think and how it is thought can only be explained in thought. And so in this sense, thought itself cannot be explained. Now, this too, no doubt, can be disappointing. But however disappointing it might be, we know that, coming from Kant, it's not an expression of evasion or complacency or a
Just a question about the diagnosis you offered at one point. You were pointing out that when we give explanations of things, we have to say something. To say something, we can be understood. We have to understand the meaning of what is said. So when we give explanations of what we mean, there seems to be a circle that creates a certain kind of dissatisfaction. I want someone breaking out of that circle and giving an account of what is meant that doesn't in turn involve understanding what is meant and the offering of the explanation. And then that part of the diagnosis. And that's where my question comes in, about how to understand that diagnosis, what the, I suppose, level of generality of it is. And the reason I ask is because it seems to me that the point about understanding things from the outside, and we try to understand things from the outside, the lights go out in a certain kind of way, we get caught up in a certain kind of philosophical problem, is a matter Wittgenstein's interested in more generally. That is, understanding linguistic expressions is an instance of a larger case of a kind of philosophical perplexity that's generated, which it seems to me there's many examples. But to take an example that comes up a lot in Wittgenstein, what is it to, as it were, understand what another person is expressing, whether it be pain or joy or sadness or grief? We can give a description of, as it were, the phenomenon from the outside, where what we have is mere bodily movements which are described in a psychologically neutral way. And then we can ask, how do those add up to an expression of grief or joy? And we're going to have a similar sort of problem, I take it. And then it seems to be part, and then Wittgenstein's solution to that problem, to put it very elliptically for a moment, is not unlike the solution he sketches in 201. That is, there has to be a way of grasping what another expresses that is not an interpretation of bodily movement. So that's just an instance, but if it's right that there's various cases of this, then I want the diagnosis of this case to turn on something special about language and the fact that we use language in giving explanations of what expressions mean. It involves a special kind of circularity. I would want the point to turn on, to be sufficient in general, that where we have, as it were, a significance or intentional content is to be grasped. There's going to be a version of this issue in perception, there's going to be a version of this issue with respect to understanding other minds and so forth, where the understanding of linguistic items is just one case of a general phenomenon. And nothing you said, it seemed to me, resisted that thought, but some of your phraseology in your diagnosis involved the sort of use of the term language that might seem that you think that ultimately is the crucial case, where the case itself involves a diagnosis that ultimately turns on features of language, so that these other cases would be outside of the range of this investigation.
I agree with what you're saying, which makes it hard for me to be sure I understand what you're referring to by what you call the diagnosis that I offer. There is a similarity in that if we didn't naturally recognize expressions of grief, pain, joy, and so on, there wouldn't be any way for us to, as it were, construct such expressions out of mere bodily movements that we could observe or that are available to us. And that is similar to the, structurally similar to the point about meaning. But I'm not sure what you're suggesting I said that makes it look as if the key to all of that is something to do with language. I'm not sure.
There's a moment that went by quickly, and it involved both the words meaning and language. There's a certain question on which word you hit. That's why it was a genuine question, not a judgment. One thing we could say is, well, the reason there's a dissatisfaction here is because there's a special kind of circle we get into when we're trying to understand linguistic expressions, that in our accounts of what we mean by such expressions, we have to use language. And we need to understand something special about that circle. And if one puts it that way, then it looks like the diagnosis turns on something peculiar about language and a kind of circularity that comes up when philosophical reflection takes language as object. If you use the word meaning instead, and both words came up, then one can think something like significance or intentional content, something like that, would be other cases of grasping a meaning. We don't usually think of, well, you could say, what does his expression mean? Well, he's smiling, it means joy. Forget the word meaning.
Okay.
But it's not the philosopher of language's preferred use of the word meaning.
No, I understand now. I was speaking about a dissatisfaction that one finds in trying to understand language, meaning of linguistic expressions, that, as you point out, is structurally similar to the kind of thing one can feel in recognizing other forms of intentional behavior. And I think perhaps, well, I was focusing on the way in which that dissatisfaction leads to a desire for what is usually called a philosophical theory of meaning, linguistic meaning, language meaning, which I think comes out of this kind of paradoxical situation. Saying that that is the source of a philosophical demand of the understanding of language, of course, does not deny the structural similarities of other things. Now, there is a similar philosophical, has been a similar philosophical desire expressed with respect to the recognition of the expression of intention, psychological states, of course, that would be an attempt to, as it were, reduce them somehow to the bodily movements that are observable. So it's true, I was focusing here only on the, or primarily on the linguistic case, but not in a way that I hope would deny the similarities that you're mentioning these other things. So if there was something like a diagnosis that I was offering, it would be a diagnosis of a particular case or the demand in a particular case for a philosophical theory of meaning, an account, as it were, that would answer the question that Kripke's book poses. What is it that constitutes a person's meaning or understanding something in a particular way? But the question could be asked, what is it that constitutes a person's being joyful or having a pain or being in grief and so on?
Well, going maybe a bit far from your subject or your topic, I would like to know your opinion. Do you think that Dickinson could be a relativist in some sense that this expression would have?
Could you just mention maybe one sense it could have, or say a bit more about what? Relativist.
Well, you say there is no necessary and sufficient conditions about somebody meaning something.
There are no necessary and sufficient conditions which we can discover which will imply that something means something or other, when those conditions are expressed without using intentional terms about what person means or understands by the expressions he uses. No, as it were, reduction of statements about linguistic meaning to something that involves no assertions about any science meaning anything. That's really what I'm, that's the position that I'm identifying as Wittgenstein. I still don't think I see the connection between that kind of idea and something called relativism. So maybe you could say a bit more.
I'm thinking of some examples because they use that one of in the beginning of the remarks of mathematical foundation. same?
Well, examples like that, that example is given of people who might, who do some things that look in certain respects similar to the kinds of things that we do. And in fact, he calls that a case of selling wood by different means. Now, that really is a case of selling wood or not, is perhaps something to be disputed or discussed in that case. As he describes it, they exchange some money for some wood, and they have a pattern of doing this, so in that sense it could be called selling wood. But I don't see anything, it's the term relativism that I'm having trouble with. I mean, they just do it differently. From the way we do it, we say, if we understand them as, in this case, selling wood, we think, as Wittgenstein imagines it, that we could point out to them their, as we would see it, mistake. That is, we take a pile that is, by their standards, quite small, and we spread it around so that it becomes quite big. And they say, so now it's more, so it costs more. How we are to understand all of that, I don't know, I mean, in detail, but if we understand it as a case of their selling wood, then that's that. I mean, that's how they do it. I feel this doesn't satisfy you, but I don't know what the point is.
Could I just say what I know? A word or two about ostensive definitions, which you were saying they were a natural way to begin. And ostensive definitions are really just one way, and a rather artificial way, of course, of beginning to learn language. You can, and what they are really is, according to Wittgenstein, he talks about Erläuterungen, of course he talks already in fact about Erläuterungen. They're simply ordinary statements containing the primitive terms, the terms that you want to teach, which in this case are used to teach them. I mean, so that the person learns the language by, the person learns the language by using it. I mean, it's not that he gets a first use of something else, that he can just, he gets to use a perfectly ordinary proposition such as that. It may be a proposition such as that is red. Or maybe, like Einstein, my soup is too hot, or something like that. It could be of any kind of proposition that you use in that way. There is, of course, the other question about how you teach foreign languages when you do give an English equivalent, but I'm sure you can account for that in perfectly satisfactory way.
No, I agree with that. You're quite right. I mean, to be really strict about it, one should. What got distinguished is in the early sections of the investigations between what he calls the ostensive teaching and the ostensive training. And those separating those elements in that way, you have first, just as it were, the repetition of a sound in the presence of an object of a certain kind. And that doesn't fix anything. And that's not, and Wittgenstein is careful not to call that an ostensive definition. It's just some ostension that goes on. For there to be a sense of definition, that means it serves to define the term, then it's true that the person has to be capable of using the thing in a certain way, so that, for example, it turns out to be a color word rather than a numeral or whatever it might be. And that will typically be, although, of course, in the very earliest section of the investigations, it turns out not to be distinguishable as used in a sentence as opposed to a term. But once you get to having any kind of internal structure of the sentences, then the person must be able to use the term in a certain way, and that would be in a sentence. The only thing I was really wanting to stress, it does seem, I think, extremely important that this happens at some stage in the presence of things. but not as if the meaning of the term is somehow to be read off the thing that's present. And that, in that sense, I agree with you that the as soon as it's sentential, then you've got a lot of structure there which cannot be gleaned from the presence of any object described, so to speak, from outside.
I'd like to come back to the original question with Conan, because I'm not convinced that the way you are dealing with the original question. The problem, as far as I see, is not whether there is or is not a kind of similarity in what is inside the description of linguistics, what is outside. And the same ideas apply to looking at intentional phenomena from inside, outside. The crucial question is, I think, that the crucial connection is that if language must speak for itself, there must be something previous to language that must speak for itself. In the sense that when you have a dialectic that ends by insisting that explanations must end somewhere, it's very important to focus what is, to point exactly what is somewhere is. Not because you put at its opponent is going to be right otherwise, but because for dialectical purposes, the illusion that he is right can be more powerful. And in the case, what I mean is that first, that any strategy as you must, as you are following, I think, has to insist that internal collections in language a condition, there is some condition of possibility of those internal connections in language that is not the kind of misguiding foundation that your opponent is looking for, but has to do with what Conan was pointing to about internal connections in expressive behavior, I would say. That is not only a, I insist on that because I don't think it's not only an exegetical point, I think it is. Okay, Wittgenstein's theory of intentionality was developed previously to following a rule, and it's basic to understand that. Also because I think that is connected much more clearly with his own development of the picture theory. I mean, the theory of intentionality is quite autonomous, in the sense that, well, remind all those attempts to fit the picture theory and the intentionality in the 30s, and his rebuttal from Russell's theory of intentionality as an attempt to introduce self. And that is the first moment in which the idea of an internal connection, in the sense that generate the inside and outside dialectic, is establishing Wittgenstein development. And also, apart from this exegetical point, because I think that the problems are much more clear. I mean, how misguiding is the idea of looking for some external foundation? If we focus on primitive cases of intentionality, then if we focus in most sophisticated cases of linguistic practices.
Yes, I think the phenomenon or the fact that we recognize the expressive intentional behavior of others is, of course, something that doesn't require language, independent language, and the understanding of language must somehow be understood as connected with that. That is, that we can see and recognize what people are doing. We can do that even when what they're doing is not linguistic, and that matters. That's, if you want to call that a foundation of language, you could. But it isn't, it doesn't stand in any foundational relation to the whole area of meaning, where that means our capacity to recognize intentional behavior. So I'm not sure that I understand what's behind what you're saying, but I would want to connect our capacity to understand what people say and mean with our capacity to recognize other things that people express and mean. It's only because language is part of people doing things together that it has the thing, linguistic items have the meaning that they do. That seems to me to be right. But I don't know whether that goes as far as what you were suggesting.
What I'm suggesting is that, for instance, in the case of intentionality, in the case of linguistic practices, what is an internal question and what is an external question is more easily confused than in the case of basic intentional attribution.
Can I stop you there? Because, see, the way in which Wittgenstein uses that phrase, from outside, that I pick up on, I think that it applies across this whole spectrum, so that trying to see what someone is expressing from outside recognition of the content of that expression by doing it in terms of the movements of their face or their arms or something is impossible, he's saying. That is, that would be a sense of trying to understand an expression of something having a certain significance from outside giving anything that anybody does any significance and trying to describe it in terms of stuff that doesn't have any significance. Now that sense of outside is cutting to all of it, whether it's that not just applies to linguistic behavior. So in that sense, that's the sense of outside, not the sense in which seeing how people respond when they don't speak is something outside language. That's not the sense of outside that I think is at work here. It's outside anything significant, anything that has any significance. And that's where the common, I mean, I think what Tim Cohen said is completely right. That's the common element between linguistic behavior and non-linguistic phenomena, to which the same idea applies.
Robert?
Sure.
should restrict the term interpretation means so and so. Now that's quite uncharacteristic that he makes a remark about what we should or how we should or should not use a term. But I think he does that because he's already made clear that what he means in that case by an interpretation is the substitution of or the production of one expression which is meant to stand in the synonymous or interpretative relation to another expression, and that's what is regressive. And of course, that's the thing that Kripke's exploits. Actually, I hadn't realized that I hadn't quoted that in the past, but in any case, I had it strongly in mind that given that understanding of what it is to interpret. Now, of course, it sounds odd to say that when I hear something and understand it, I don't interpret it in another sense. So I think Wittgenstein is carefully distinguishing between interpreting something and supplying what he calls, in that case, an interpretation of it, where that's a thing, that's an expression or an item, as opposed to being in the intentional attitude, so to speak, of interpreting something or understanding it.
Yes, at a high level, interpretation can be a very high level, I guess, in understanding the place in certain words with other words, and that can be foundation, obviously.
Right.
That can be foundation, because it really does, as just as last sense of definition, presupposes an ongoing language with some sophistication of interpretation. So he's thinking about it, and then he's just a very critical one he came to at the beginning, when he talks about the way we're going to follow the rule. This is a friendly suggestion.
Yeah, no,
check later on, and I can verify or falsify, and so on, and so on. And I'm concerned about this practical intelligibility, how I understand what people do, because I understand perfectly well, I can always frame someone's action under a rule. And that's probably what psychologists or psychiatrists do all the time. They try to make sense of what the patient does by a hypothesis like this is the rule that person is following, either in his thinking or in his action, or both, which is the same. Well, in that sense, with that premise that every time I face someone, I try to make sense of what that she or does or thinks, under that premise, it follows that there is no way I face mystery. There is no way I when I face something, I don't understand anything. I always try and understand anything. Something like being confronted with enigma, with mystery, is just not the possibility for human beings. It's just not the way we live, think, or act, or react to other people. Well, and I wasn't sure that describes what human beings are all the time. I think usually we do that. Usually we work under intentionality. That is, we have to think, desire, wish, expect something. It's always human beings are intentional beings, most of the time. I am not sure, and that's something I am not sure whether that is all the time. That is, whether sometimes it's not the case that I just have no clue of what is going on, either with others' behavior or with my behavior. In that sense of what happens, for example, in maybe that is what a good description for anguish, for depression, for mentally ill for mental processes where the person is having troubles with himself and the others are having troubles with that person. And so The point is that when you relate this friend Wittgenstein and friend with Kant, I always thought of Wittgenstein as being someone who would say, okay, there is no transcendent foundation of language. There is no basis for language outside language, in that sense of transcendent. But the kind of research of language that we can develop is a transcendental, that is conditions of possibility of language. I'm sorry, but that would make sense for me. The problem with Kant is that he did that kind of transcendental research. For example, in morality, he said that if morality is possible, it has to be under the condition of freedom. Freedom is a condition of possibility for morality. He doesn't say that freedom is granted. He doesn't say we can prove that freedom is. He only says if morality is possible, freedom is granted. And in that sense, in connection, in relation to meaning, I would just like to comment that all of these would say that if we understand each other, if we can make sense of each other, etc., etc., meaning has to be understood in the way we've been telling us. But maybe sometimes there is enigma, or there is unintelligibility. And that would be interesting to understand it, or to talk about it precisely in relation to practical actions more than to theoretical discourse.
Yes, I see. I think I don't think there's anything in the idea that we have to be to recognize the intentional states expressed in the behavior of our fellow human beings in order for human life and language to work. I don't think there's anything in all of that which would suggest that we can never find any mystery or never be completely baffled by something or other that people do. But we can only be baffled about what they do because we already have the idea of understanding what people do, and in this particular case or in that particular case, we find we're blocked. We can't do it. We have the idea of doing it, but we can't do it. And I think it's only because we can do it so much of the time that we have the idea of doing it. So in that sense, there's no implication that it's, as it were, easy or always available. Now, the comparison with Kant maybe suggests that if you think of Wittgenstein stressing these kinds of things in a way that puts him back, puts him in a parallel to Kant, maybe there's the idea in Kant that the way he understands it, these, what he thinks of as the necessary conditions of the possibility of thought and experience, must in some sense always be available to us. And there is, I think, an implication of that in general in Kant because of his transcendental investigation, which is investigation into the necessary condition of the possibility of thought, which he regards as being possible only a priori. And he does think that because these conditions are in us, they must in some sense be to us. And maybe it's because you're thinking of that parallel that you think there ought to be the same kind of availability of particular understandings of people on the picture that Wittgenstein is presenting, but I don't see that there's a parallel there at all. So I agree with you that there can be mysteries, we can have no clue on particular cases, we can be baffled, and that's perfectly consistent with the indispensability of what I'm calling this engaged understanding of each other, without which no human life would be possible. Well, maybe I'll stop at that.
Well,
session will resume at 4:30.
Teoricamente no lo podría ser. Teoricamente no lo podría
ser. Ya, eso sí.
Porque no lo podría ser.